All right, welcome back to the show, and thank you guys so much for joining us. And we have a very, very special guest with us today, somebody that I've been looking forward to interviewing for a really long time, never honestly thought I'd get the chance to. This is a gentleman who's had an impact on the way that we manage money, somebody that we've followed for a long time, a giant in the industry. I'm sure he wouldn't refer to himself as that, but I will do that for him. But anyway, without further ado, Mr. Roger Ibbotson, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, it's great to be here.
Okay, so I'm going to go down. Now, there are certain topics that we really want to cover because, as I've said, you've had an impact in the way that we manage our clients' money, the way that we run our business. But I have to start with the beginning of your career, just because I think it's fascinating, the people that you've worked with, the work that you've done. Tell us a little bit about, you know, your beginnings, you know, the incredible people that you've had the opportunity to work with. Kind of give us the story about how you started and how you got where you are.
What really propelled me in this field was getting my PhD at the University of Chicago. Before that, I actually wasn't exactly planning on getting a PhD after I got my MBA, but I had a few jobs that really didn't work out, and I was trying to figure out what to do. And so I went back to school to get a PhD. And of course, at the University of Chicago at that time, I have to say, this is a while back. I graduated in the 70s. But at the University of Chicago at that time, it was really the center of so many things that were happening because, for example, the Black-Scholes model, options model came out, and Fisher Black and Myron Scholes were on my committee. The idea of efficient capital markets came out, and Eugene Fama was the chairman of my committee, and of course the Miller Modigliani perspective on corporate finance, which totally changed the way you look at corporate finance, and Merton Miller was on my committee. So I had a wonderful group of people to work with, and I actually ended up staying on the faculty at the University of Chicago as well before I came to Yale in 1984, actually. So I've been at Yale now for 35 years. Taking us back a second, actually the first real job that I had of a success was while I was a PhD. While I was a PhD student, I actually was asked to be a consultant to the investment office of the university's endowment. And one of the things they asked me about is, what should we do with this bond portfolio? And I said, well, I can manage that. And so I ended up managing the bond portfolio while I was a PhD student, actually. So I actually got some real hands-on experience as well. And then I ended up on the faculty at Chicago, as they say, for 10 years after that. So it was a great start. But then, of course, Yale's been a great place to be, too.
And you've been a professor of finance now at Yale for how long has that now been? Is it 30 years?
35 years. I mean, of course, it makes me so young, but but it's 35 years.
And what's fascinating to me is all the work that you've done and as influential as you've been in the world of finance. And from reading about you and hearing previous interviews, you alluded to this, but you weren't really targeting a career in finance. I believe that you thought you were or the original plan was to join the family business. Is that not correct?
Well, yeah, my father had a Ibbotson Heating Company, actually. It's still in the family, actually. It's another couple generations down already running the business, but it stayed in the family. And I would have probably gone into that business myself if I had more mechanical skills, and I have to admit that I didn't. And my father would have forgiven me for what I didn't know, but still, I wanted to do something I was better at. And actually, finance is the perfect sort of thing because it is practical, but it's sufficiently abstract where you don't really get your hands dirty. So it's actually been the perfect kind of career for me.
Well, I sit there and I wonder sometimes. It's certainly a noble practice, great business. You know, I think that the world is better off with you in the world of finance, the field of finance, as opposed to heating and air conditioning and things of that nature. So I think you made a good choice.
I'm not saying you shouldn't heat your houses and air condition your houses. I think those are important things to do too.
Oh, absolutely.
However, for me, I really had to relate to what I was actually good at, which was I've always been good quantitatively, I guess, and good at understanding concepts and so forth. And of course, I can't fix anything. Mechanically, I can't fix anything. I think I can fix financial problems.
That's probably one of the only things that we have in common. I'm right there with you. I've been better on the number side than the engineering side or the practical, fixing things. That's really not my forte. But anyway, wanted to move on. The other thing that's always fascinated me about you and your work, as you mentioned, is the people that you worked with. You were on the ground. I think about this all the time. I was watching a documentary about long-term capital the other day. I knew the story. I knew that the basis of their model was based off Black-Scholes. And while prepping for the interview, I forgot that those were two of your colleagues, close colleagues that you worked with. Black and Scholes. It just amazes me how many of the things that you've been right smack dab in the middle of. The listeners of our radio show may not know this, but Black Scholes really transformed the world of finance in many ways, in some ways the world. Did you meet those? How did you guys come together? You said they were on your committee. How did that group of you Chicago boys, how did that come together? What was the genesis of that?
We had a lot of things going on at the University of Chicago. Of course, we had Milton Friedman there at the time. And I took his courses and so forth. But the finance group, I guess, was one of the really hot areas, really with I probably started with Gene Fama really pushing, Gene Fama and Merton Miller really pushing, but actually their students were actually Myron Scholes is one of their students and so forth. So he came into the picture and so forth. So this was a group that just happened to be there, and a lot of the most important discoveries were happening at the University of Chicago. Of course, there were other universities like MIT and so forth, which were also involved. But it was definitely a time of huge discoveries going on in investments. And really changing the whole field, because once you recognize that markets are relatively efficient, the whole way you look at markets is much simpler. Once you see the Black-Scholes models, you understand how arbitrage works and how options and so forth can be priced. So we're really getting a theoretical grounding on how the markets worked. I also, as I say, I was a bond portfolio manager, so I could see a lot of those concepts, which had been developed earlier, but were really first getting applied, like duration and term structures of interest rates and so forth. So it was really a wonderful place to start. I got to say, though, that Yale's also been a wonderful place to be at, because I've been a professor at Yale since 1984, and Yale has really developed on the behavioral finance side. And so, I have a new monograph, a new book called Popularity, A Bridge Between Classical and Behavioral Finance. So classical finance is things like rationality and efficient markets, and behavioral finance allows for emotions and irrationality. And once you can put all that together, you really see the whole perspective on capital markets.
And I'm glad you brought that up. One more jot down on my list was talk to you about this new book based on popularity. I've read a lot of your work on this, and I think it's fascinating. But before I get to that, one of the things that's interested me so much about your career and your life is, and I don't know how many people know this, but you are not just a professor of finance. You also run a finance, or you run a hedge fund, a fund, Zebra Capital, and you are intimately involved in other, you know, financial matters. The work that you're doing on the annuity side of things, you've got your hands in a lot of things, and then you're also in the world of academia. There's not a lot of guys that straddle those lines. What was the first love? Was it the finance side, or was it the instruction, or did you see, or teaching, being a professor, or did you see those two things marrying up? Did you see them kind of as an extension of the other? What was the first love, and do you think that one helps you be better at the other? How does that union work? It's not very common.
Well, it's always been synergistic for me. These things work together. So I was, of course, first interested in finance and economics, but I always leaned toward the practical side. So a lot of it seemed like deep theory, and I always was looking for ways to apply this. And, of course, one of the ways to apply this is in, I started out as consulting, and one of the things we can talk about shortly is stocks, bonds, bills, and inflation, all the data sets that I built. But after building those data sets, there was so much interest in this that people were asking me to be a consultant all over the place. And so I started a consulting business, Ibbotson Associates, which I eventually, years later, sold to Morningstar.
Yeah.
In 2006, but it was a data and software business, a financial data and software business. And so, and it's only after that that I really focused on Zebra Capital, where we were building hedge funds, equity management, and of course, various indexes that are used in annuity products. But I guess the overall theme here is all the research that I've done, and I've done, of course, a lot of research over the years, research, teaching, running businesses, they're all very interconnected, and they all feed on each other. So I don't actually necessarily think of them as so distinct activities. I think of them as you might say I've got a lot of work to do. The fact that I've got teaching and research and running businesses, it seems like I'm really an overly busy person or something like that. But that's not quite true. It's because so many of the things that you do in one field actually applies to the other field. And so you're always like double dipping in everything you do, I guess.
Yeah, well, if you're one of those guys that can proficiently operate in both fields, which is not the most common thing. Now, on your work on popularity, it's probably a topic that the vast majority of our listeners have not heard discussed as it relates to finances and investing. And I have found it to be endlessly fascinating because I feel like for me, it put words and research to things that I had thought about, but in very non-direct, non-accurate or non-defined ways. And then reading your work, it was kind of like the light went on. You know, it kind of reminded me of physics. You know, you observe these things your whole life, and then you go start going through physics classes, and you go, oh, that's why that works that way. Oh, that makes sense. It was kind of a light bulb going on moment for me. Can you, and before I botch it, because I am not even close to an expert on this, but can you give our listeners a summation of some of the work that you've done, as well as your new book on popularity? Like I said, I find it endlessly fascinating, and I would love to know. I feel like that work, from my perspective, is especially important today when understanding asset prices and some of the, and it's always been to a degree. But do you agree with me? Do you think that it's especially prescient right now? Or do you think it's no more prescient than it's been? So that's a lot of questions I'm throwing at you. But yeah, just go over that work and then kind of tell me where you think it fits in today.
Okay, first of all, let me say on this, it's a CFA Institute monograph that you can load for free if you go down to your site. I think you can buy it for on for about $10 or something like that, a hard copy, and you can also get it on Amazon for maybe a little more than that. So it's easily accessible, and I think it's actually very simple. In many ways, we've made investments into some complicated field here. We talk about all the different premiums you have, risk premiums, and different all these different payoffs for different factors and so forth. What we're saying is that for any of these factors or premiums to be relevant, they have to be something that is actually unpopular. In other words, anything that is any kind of security that is really popular for whatever reason, say relative to their cash flows, if investors really like it relative to their cash flows, their expected cash flows, that means they're going to raise the price, raise the valuation. But if they raise the valuation, it means they're going to have lower expected returns in the future. And so the kind of things that actually have payoffs, that you actually have the really good returns, are the things that people don't like for some reason. It may be just that they never heard of it, or they're unfamiliar with it, or something like that. Or it might be something that's, I guess, in classical economics, the key thing is if it was risky. We always knew that, and I've studied it, risky securities people don't like, and therefore they have lower valuations but higher expected returns. The higher the risk, the higher the expected return. Mm. But we're generalizing this. So no longer is it just risk. There are a lot of things we don't like. So for example, or we like or we don't like. We don't like things that are less liquid. If they're less liquid, they're going to have lower valuations. And of course, that means they will have higher returns, higher expected returns. You can see that directly in the bond market. You can look at two bonds which are identical in all respects, but one is more liquid than the other. The one that is less liquid will have a higher yield, and there will be a yield spread that will pay off for the reduction in liquidity. So that's just classical economics, classical finance, things like risk and liquidity and how things are taxed and so forth. Those are things that we can like or don't like. And popularity is just how much we like something relative to its actual underlying cash flows. And but once you bring in behavioral finance, you can get mispricing in there. So we can like things just because we like the brand or something like that, or we really know about it, and we might not like something just because we never heard of it, and we get behavioral impacts here. So popularity encompasses both the behavioral and the classical. That means it encompasses both rational thinking and irrational thinking, and it encompasses so many things beyond risk that you originally think about as the sort of the classical first thing you think about. Yes, we don't like risk. Yes, risk is unpopular. Yes, risk deserves a higher expected return. But it's not alone. There are a lot of other things we don't like that will also give us this higher expected return. So that's what this book is all about, and gives lots of examples, and it gives some empirical tests of this to demonstrate it and so forth, and it's just common sense.
Yeah.
But bringing back financial theory to things that are common sense that all of us can understand, all my life I've tried to apply things, but applying things generally means take some complicated theory and turn it into something that all of us can relate to.
Yeah, it reminds me, and we talk about this on the show all the time, reminds me of the old adage that if you really understand something, you should be able to explain it simply in a couple sentences, right? And I find, and that's what's so intriguing to me about this work. And you, like I said, you may or may not agree. I think it's especially prescient right now, especially considering this record divergence between value and growth. I feel like this is a really prescient time for this to be coming out. And I'd be lying to you if I didn't tell you I'd been scratching my head at some of the valuations that some of these popular things are getting versus some of these other businesses that I think look attractive that aren't popular and they just seem to be getting taken to the woodshed. Do you see that as well, or do you think that maybe I'm looking at, you know, a couple instances and being unfairly biased at the market? Do you think that that's a big part of what's going on today? And if not, you know, where am I wrong?
Well, it's a little bit unusual today because long term, if you look at it, the value companies have the higher returns than the growth companies.
Yeah.
The growth companies are the great companies with the great stories, and they intend to be overvalued, and they may be overvalued today. And the value companies are the companies that have some strong fundamentals, but really are not great companies, but turn out to be, because of their valuations, great stocks.
Yeah.
But what's happened recently, of course, is the growth companies have done much better than the value companies. Long-term value companies have actually done better than growth companies, but more recently, growth companies have done much better than value companies. It's a question of, so maybe value companies got to be too popular after all the literature, the financial literature saying you should buy value and not growth. But certainly now I guess we're probably getting to the point where value is more destined to have some sort of a turnaround here because growth has been has had the much higher returns over the last, really, since the crisis in 2008.
Right, yeah. Okay, so one other thing that came up, and I love your work on liquidity too, because I feel like it's again, kind of another thing that I've focused on before, and I think it's, you know, it's one of those things that once you hear it, you go, oh yeah, that makes sense. You know, if I've got no impediments or no, you know, nothing blocking me from liquidating this asset and converting it to cash or whatever, at any given time, naturally it should hold up, you know, a higher premium, a higher valuation, which is, you know, historically why we've seen, publicly traded companies with, you know, higher valuations on a relative basis to private companies. And yet, that has another thing that is switched. I know we're seeing these incredible valuations in these private companies, and private equity is, you know, grown to heights that I think at least I didn't imagine it growing to. And I think it's one of the first time in my career that I've seen these huge private equity type companies, these private firms going public and getting revalued much lower. What do you attribute that to? Again, do you think I'm nitpicking data, or am I cherry picking and looking at a few situations? Do you notice that as well, this unusual higher valuations in private markets as opposed to public? And what do you attribute that to?
Well, they do. Anything that gets popular gets more popular. I guess the real change in valuations is when things get more popular. Of course, if you're unpopular, you're going to have a relatively low valuation. The ideal security to buy is a security that's unpopular but gets more popular. And what's happened in private equity is, I guess, now it's gotten very popular, so that, yes, even when they go public, they don't go up in value. So that would suggest, of course, that private equity is too popular and might not have good returns going forward if you buy it when it's too popular. It's really your return comes from two sources here. If you getting a low valuation is one source because you essentially have a high cost of capital or high expected return. But the more immediate effect is a change in popularity. If anything gets more popular, it's going to go up in value, and anything gets less popular, it's going to go down in value. And so we see these changes in popularity, which can certainly dominate returns over the short run. But over the long run, it's ultimately the less popular securities that have the highest returns and the most popular securities that have the lowest returns. In fact, the most popular securities are more likely to get less popular. I mean, if it's already very popular, it's hard to get more popular. You're more likely to get less popular. And the ones that are likely to increase in popularity are the ones that aren't that popular to begin with. Because if you have a great company with a high growth rate, it's very hard to get better, I guess. It's hard to even sustain what you're doing.
Yeah, law of large numbers.
You often fall from being, you start out at the top, but you can easily fall from that.
You go from the penthouse to the outhouse and a lot quicker than most people think, right?
Well, I'm not going to talk about bathroom talk here.
Well, that's because you're more of a gentleman than I am. Now skipping ahead to something that I have been looking forward to speaking to you about since 2016. And again, you don't know this, but you had some research, a white paper that you put out in 2016 that was... To put it lightly, it was very encouraging to us. It was very affirming to us. It's a controversial subject in finance, and I to this day am bewildered as to why. And this is kind of a long question. I'll set it up. In 2011-ish, we started looking for alternatives to bonds for our clients. And There were several different factors that we were looking at, but the reasons that we started looking outside of the traditional stock bond allocation had a lot to do with, just interest rates, really. Interest rates hit zero. You start looking at bonds and you sit there and go, wait a second, you're asking me to pay a higher price for this security than I have ever paid. And you're expecting me to be happy with the lowest yield that I've ever received. It seemed like there was a lot of negative convexity. And also, as you know, a lot better than I do, the traditional portfolios that are in the RIA worlds and in the asset management worlds, we concentrate further and further into fixed income as the client ages to protect them against volatility. And, we do that because of these relationships between stocks and bonds that we're told when stocks go down, it's a law that bonds go up. We started looking into that and saying, well, first of all, we don't think that that's a law that's nearly as concrete as it's presented as being. We also think that the projections that we're giving our clients, if we remain in these typical allocations to bonds, we don't see how they're possibly going to get the type of returns that they're looking for. And being a guy that majored in finance and economics and, that spent my life in the financial industry, I always looked down my nose at insurance products. We were taught to believe that insurance products were unsophisticated and expensive and kind of a trick, something that the insurance, a way to cheat clients, if you will, or maybe that's too strong of a word. But I don't need to tell you, I'm sure you're aware of this. But throughout our research, looking for something to supplement our bond portfolios with, we stumbled on fixed indexed annuities. Now, we were attracted initially to a very specific kind, a kind that had little to no fees, which is possible. You hear all these people railing on annuities and they talk about expenses. And I immediately go, well, unfortunately, you don't know what you're talking about. Looking at more these annuities that are built toward accumulation, that have safety of principle, that grow. And we started using that as a bond supplement and in some cases a bond replacement. And look, the last 6-7 years have been good for equity returns, but the biggest source of outperformance for our clients has come from these products, and they've been remarkable. Not to compete against equities, not as an equity replacement, but as a bond supplement or a bond replacement. And we took a lot of flack for that. We were called out, we were questioned, we were doubted, we were seen as being less sophisticated. And when your research paper came out about this or came out in 2016, it was extremely vindicating. So first of all, thank you. Second of all, give me your take on it. And we're using it as a bond replacement, as a bond supplement. Do you think that's an appropriate role? And what about this? Do you feel that swimming upstream in this industry as it relates to these products and this reticence for people to accept them? And if so, what do you attribute that to?
Well, you asked a lot of questions here, but I'll start out with the bond part of this. Of course, bonds have actually been a great place to be over the last really 35 years.
Yeah.
Because they started out in 1981, you know, they were like 14%, even government bonds, you know. So and a bond return, you get the yield plus either a capital gain or loss. And if the yields drop, you get a capital gain. And if the yields fall, you get a capital loss. But if you bought bonds in the 1980s at these double-digit rates, you got not only that double-digit yield, but then you got a big capital gain because the rates are falling.
Phenomenal.
And so you ended up with really high returns. And this was, they've been falling really all the way through for the last 35 years.
Right.
And now they're, even the 10-year treasury is about 2.25%. So it's been a great ride. The problem is kind of going forward here, though, with bonds being at such a low rate, and then if they're likely yields are going to rise again, because they can't fall much more, if they're going to rise again, you're going to not only get that very low rate, but then a capital loss on top of that. So you can actually lose money in the bond market. That's why you want to look for some alternatives. And fixed index annuities are an alternative here that essentially they insure the floor. They're an insurance contract, of course. So they actually end up with you can't really lose money over, depending on the terms of the contract, over 1, 2, or 3 year periods. You can't lose money. And then but you get some participation. And my study actually looked at a generic product, where we looked at a generic S&P type of product, where you participated in the equity market. We looked at it long term and over the last, really since back to 1927. And over that whole period, they did a little bit better than bonds. But what was especially nice about them is that they have that floor, because they don't have any periods where you lose money, where bonds you can lose money. So having a really kind of a safe asset, at least it's safe if you have a good insurance company backing it. And by the way, we have our own product. We have an index here at my company, Zebra Capital, which is called it's in coordination with the New York Stock Exchange. It's called the New York Stock Exchange Zebra Edge Index, and it's insured by Nationwide Insurance. Well, anyway, it's very important to have if you really protect that flow, you need a good insurance company to actually protect your returns. So you need a reliable company that actually won't default on this. but the positives are, it's a better risk return distribution than you would get in the bond market, particularly today when yields are so low. And the positives are that it's really kind of customized to what you want. The reason why people complain about it, some people would complain about it, is really a couple of things. One is it's illiquid. If you want to get out of a contract early, you have to pay surrender charges. And so there's a cost structure in there. That cost structure isn't so high, though, if you commit for the whole period. And that's why this is key, that you actually have they're all sold through advisors in some way, either insurance agents or registered investment advisors. But it's important that you have a trusted advisor providing this, because these products are only designed for the kind of person who actually has a longer horizon, is planning for retirement. As they start approaching retirement, you need to take less risk, and this is a way to do it. But people do have to make that commitment. You don't want to sell this to somebody who might get out of it in a couple of years, because they're actually going to have to pay surrender charges.
Well, and one of the attractive things to us about it was, when you consider yields where they currently are, You know, and I think, and I'm sure you'd agree, and I've actually read this in your work, but I think one of the things that we forget to do in the world of finance is that all assets are relative. And so we, you know, obviously we always sit there and screen for whether a client can and is suited for these products and if they can hold on to them to maturity. And we do liquidity planning to make sure there's enough and make sure it's appropriate. At the same time, when you factor in yields, where yields currently are and what bonds are paying, less advisory fees and 12b1 fees and all the things that usually come along with it, it really minimizes even those early termination costs. I mean, obviously, it depends on the performance of the annuity. I just look at this and I think, you know, relative to current yields, even considering the termination costs, these products are, again, assuming they're the right ones, assuming that they're used correctly, they've never been cheaper. If you hold one of these products, let's say for 5 years and it's a 10-year product, and even if you need to liquidate it, and again, I'm not advocating that this is the right way to use them, but one of the things that we always look at when setting up client portfolios is what could go wrong. And what would we do if it did? And you look at the relative performance of a lot of these products versus what they could make in a bond fund, and that risk of that early termination cost just keeps getting smaller and smaller. Is that a fair way to look at that?
I certainly believe that the risk return structure is going to be far better than today's bonds.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter primarily of making sure that the right kind of people buy this. It's not for everybody, but it's the kind of investor who actually has a longer horizon and is really planning for retirement.
Right, and then
the natural buyer of this product. So yes, there's certainly a natural clientele who this is an appropriate product for, and I guess if people. The complaints about it might be that it might be missold to some people or something like that. That's certainly possible, but the onus is on the RIAs to actually make sure that you match the product to the customer, because effectively these are very customized products.
Right.
They're matched to what people want, and when anytime you have a customized product, of course, people need help in how to actually buy the product. If you bought a customized suit, you need help in helping somebody customizing it for you. Here you need help with the purveyor of the product, essentially making sure that you're getting the right kind of product to meet your needs.
Yeah, I appreciate the fact that you brought up your index, the Zebra Capital Index. And as a matter of fact, I just allocated a new client to that index inside of a Nationwide product yesterday. So I'm a big fan of how that index works inside of these products. And I think it's assuming that it's correct and it's an appropriate investment for the client. We've been thrilled with it. And I think it's incredible. What do you assign? One of the things, and I've spoken at conferences about this and I've had debates on air about this. There is so much pushback when it comes to these products. Now, one of the things that we've talked about on a lot on our show, and I've talked to our clients, is I have seen bad annuity products. I have seen them sold inappropriately. One of the things that we've talked about extensively is that a lot of the negativity surrounding these products is A, just misguided. People don't know what they're talking about. Or B, it's from a completely inappropriate use, but it's not the fault of the product. Used correctly, it is, they're outstanding. I even heard a recent interview you did, and I'm not going to be, you know, call anybody out, but it was funny when this topic came up, it was brushed over rather quickly. You could kind of tell that the person you were talking to wasn't a fan of these products. At least that's the way it came across to me. What do you think the pushback is in the normal, you know, in the traditional asset management world? Is it simply, you know, that they were all brought up in the game like I was to believe that insurance products were horrible? Is it because they're stuck in yesteryear looking at the bond returns of the last 40 years? What is that pushback? Why are these products seen as, you know, false gold or what is that? I've never really, when we started looking at the return profile of these, the safety, the cost, it just seemed to make sense. And yet there's so much pushback in the industry. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I attribute it to the fact that they might be missold in some cases, that you do need a longer-term commitment to be the appropriate buyer of these products. And I guess in some instances, if you sell them and then you sell them again and over again to get the commissions or something like that, that would be a downside. It's really important that you have a trusted advisor here who actually matches the products appropriately to the clients. There is a cost structure, but it's not that high. It's basically an upfront cost that's absorbed by the insurance company, and that's why it doesn't show up at your base level. You, in fact, it's taken out of your return over the years, so you don't end up with any. If you put $100 in, it's always worth at least $100 over the whole period. You don't have any danger of it falling below that 100, but there is some cost coming out of your return, of course. But it's amortized over the whole period of the contract, and therefore, I guess if you terminate early, then of course the amortization stops and you have to take it out and it shows up in the surrender charge. So that's the real, I guess, negative part of this, but it's not negative if you match up the appropriate clients with the products.
Yeah, I mean,
let me say something else. So we actually have our own index. As I said, you mentioned that you put a client into that, the NYSE Zebra Edge Index. That is one of the benefits. We've talked about popularity before. Our actual index is designed to buy the less popular large cap stocks. And these stocks tend to have a little higher return than the other large cap stocks. But even more importantly, they're lower risk.
Right.
And once you have a lower risk equity index involved here, we actually control the risk of the whole index by mixing it with bonds and cash. But once you start out with a lower risk equity, and popularity-based indexes are lower risk, you can put more equity into it. And so what that means is that the equity participation of our index is higher than most other products here, because it starts out with a equity that is lower risk, and insurance companies are insuring the fact that it won't fall below zero. But what's the most important characteristic that they look at that it won't fall below zero? And that is, what's the volatility of the equity part of this? And our part is low. So that's why actually we think our index is really the appropriate product for this marketplace.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And what we've looked at is especially with some of the features that the Nationwide product has come out with, the behavior, and again, I'm not saying it's the same, it's different, it's an insurance contract, but the behavior of these products is quite a bit like a balanced mutual fund that's just insured against loss. It amazes me the similarities and the return profiles. And yet if you go out and try to pitch somebody a balanced mutual fund, you know, that's perfectly acceptable. Yet if you basically take the same approach inside of an insurance wrapper that insures it against loss, now all of a sudden, you know, eyelids are going up and people are, they're bad products. I think that, like I said, I think they mirror a lot those balanced mutual fund returns and do it with a much lower risk profile. So it's been phenomenal for our clients. Again, we're using them appropriately. We're planning for liquidity. It's part of a balanced portfolio and diversification and, you know, all those other things. But yeah, I just wanted to thank you for that. That was a big benefit to us and a confidence builder, because, you know, I think any good investor, you're always looking at how you can be wrong and what am I missing and why are these people that I think are relatively smart people, you know, slandering the products or saying how bad they are. And yet our clients' results and outcomes have been phenomenal. So your research paper did a lot to kind of bolster our approach and give us confidence that we weren't, you know, selling fool's gold, or that we weren't doing something inappropriate for the client. So I greatly appreciate that. Now, go ahead.
Yeah, I think think of it as a balanced mutual fund, and particularly in our case, if it's popularity based, it's a balanced mutual fund that could have more equities in it than most other balanced mutual funds, and it's insured on the downside,
right?
So it doesn't have any losses. So yes, those are very, very nice risk return characteristics.
Yeah, it worked for us. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you this. This is something that we've been struggling with, and it's kind of captivated my attention probably for the last year and a half. I know you've done a ton of work on value. And we've already talked about the divergence between growth and value that I think so many people are aware of. But there's something interesting that we've been looking at. That, you know, you've got many different ways to calculate value. The one that people are most probably familiar with is the traditional PE, you know, whether it's trailing 12 or whether it's forward PE. And then you've got the more, not to you certainly, but the more esoteric types of valuation metrics like, the Buffett approach, GNP versus total market cap, price versus sales. You got all these different metrics to look at. And one of the things that's confounded us a bit is that virtually all valuation metrics, when we look at public markets today, U.S.-based public markets, all valuation metrics are at or near historic highs. And yet, P.E. ratios are not. I have done an exhaustive amount of research looking into this and trying to figure out exactly why this divergence, trying to understand what it means. Is one of those valuation metrics wrong? Is that something that you have noticed yourself? And if so, can you shed some light on that and hopefully illuminate why that divergence is taking place?
Well, you know, first of all, there's no one PE measure. There's a forward PE, there's a trailing PE, there's a CAPE, a 10-year PE, you know.
Yep.
There's firms are using pro forma PEs instead of the generally accepted accounting principles. And often when we're quoting these PE ratios, we're quoting them off of the pro forma numbers. Those are, of course, higher earnings than the generally accepted accounting principles. So there are so many different ways of actually presenting a PE ratio. And so I would say that I haven't literally noticed what you're saying, because there's so many ways of looking at a PE ratio itself. And some of them certainly look like they're way too high, and some of them don't. But of course, and there's a certain degree that you can manipulate earnings to a certain extent too. And
yeah,
whether you're more likely to do that late in the cycle when you're harder and harder to make gains here. But one of the reasons we've had such great earnings, frankly, has to do with the tax cuts that we had last year. And most of those have shown up now in the earnings, but they won't necessarily show up as further rises, I guess.
Right, right. I guess the divergence we were pointing to, and these are extreme times. So again, this is your field of expertise, so I could be out of bounds. But what we were really referring to is if you look at other periods of time where specifically GDP or GNP versus total market capitalization were in the neighborhoods of where they currently are, the really only two comparable times are 1929 and 1999. And when we look at what the PE on the overall, the traditional just price to earnings, you know, generally accepted, you know, the one that's quoted everywhere, the price to earnings multiples were substantially higher in both of those instances when market cap versus GDP or market cap versus sales or, you know, all these other metrics that we look at, whenever they were in this neighborhood they currently are, PE ratios were substantially higher. And this one kind of stands out. When we look at it, we're sitting there going, why is this one at this historically high average? Or, you know, like I said, the only two times we could find comparable were 99 and 29. And yet the price to earnings multiple is elevated. The traditional PE metric is elevated. But it's nowhere near what it was, you know, during those other periods of time when GDP or GNP versus market capitalization were in the neighborhoods they currently are. Anyway, it's just been confounding to us. And I know there's a bunch of different ways to calculate PE, but I if you took a stab at it, do you think that stock buybacks have something to do with it? I don't know. Maybe you, I had to run this by you just because it's been a head scratcher for us.
I guess I don't have the answer. I'm sorry.
Well, if you don't have the answer, then I don't think we're going to find it.
I think I could look into this. Of course, it's an intriguing question, and maybe I should have had the answer. So maybe I had something that I definitely should look further into.
Well, that if you do, I would love to somehow hear what your thoughts are, because we've been asking this question again, really trying not to come at it from a biased direction, just saying, wait a second, why is this so different? And trying to wrap our heads around maybe what it means, what's caused it. And we've asked a lot of people who are substantially smarter than I am, which that's a long list. but nobody has an answer to that. And so anyway, it's just an intriguing thing for my inner researcher. It's something that we've stumbled across and we've been yet to come up with an answer. So anyway, if you do some work on that, please make us privy to it, because I would love to see what you found and what your conclusions were. While I've still got you here, I'd be remiss again if I didn't ask you this is certainly a broader question. But where do you think there's so many interesting, confounding, exciting, fill your adjective in with whatever you want. But it's a different world we're living in. The world of finance and investing is very unique now. It's hard to find a comparable period. What do you make of what's going on in the world of finance right now? And do you think we're overvalued? What do you make of this record long run? Certainly central banks and tax cuts have played a role. What is your overall take of markets currently and valuations and just your 30,000 foot view of the world of finance as you see it?
Well, I'll start out with the economy. The U.S. economy, of course, is going great guns. The world economy is running into far more barriers here, even the big growth economies like China, are likely to be hurt by all these trade constraints and so forth, trade agreements or non-agreements. So, but I guess I'm not too optimistic that we can continue to sustain it. I think it's been partly sustained by low interest rates and partly sustained by usually you don't have low interest rates and a lot of fiscal deficits at this stage of the cycle, because usually when the economy is running hot is not when you're still trying to stimulate the economy with low interest rates and tax cuts and so forth. So these are sort of mismatched as to the timing of these things. What it does mean is when you do run into trouble, you don't have any tools in your toolkit to put out the fire, I guess. I'm mixing a lot of metaphors here, but
I love it.
It's a little difficult if you overstimulate the economy, I guess, and I think that's sort of happening here. But the world economy is not happening the same way. And so I think it starts off with when the economy itself starts cooling, when earnings show some weakness, then that's when the stock market's going to get hurt.
Okay. Well,
so that certainly can happen here, especially when it's potentially overvalued.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's an interesting world, and it's certainly an interesting time to be managing money. That's for sure. Well, Doctor, I cannot appreciate and tell you thank you enough for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. And for those people that would like to, read your work, your new book on popularity is out, and they can get it on Amazon. Is there a better place to get it? They order it off your website. How do we get access?
They could order it off of the CFA Institute Research Foundation website, too. So those are the two places they could get. They could actually download a free copy from the CFA Institute website. If they want an electronic copy, they can download it for free.
Well,
but it isn't expensive. You know, it's fine to buy. And yes, you can buy it on Amazon or off the CFA Institute website.
And the other thing I want to plug, too, is for the other investment advisors out there, I would strongly suggest that you put your bias aside and read Dr. Ibbotson's white paper that was issued in 2016, which they can find all over the internet. We've also got it as a resource on our website at bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. And I think in my personal view of this, and you can tell me if I'm misguided, but I think that these products are going to become increasingly utilized. I think that they are going to not be seen as such an aberration, that they're going to grow in popularity for a lot of the reasons that you and I have discussed. Do you have that sense as well? Do you think we're going to see much more of a proliferation of these products being used in more traditional investment management and especially in retirement planning?
I think that's already happening. So
yeah.
I think that it's actually these accumulation annuities are really growing right now.
Yeah, and looking at some of the other products they've got coming out, it's just it's a space that's really, really growing and really developing. Well, anyway, Doctor, I know you're a busy man. We'll let you go. I cannot appreciate you coming on enough. And if you look into our valuation quandary, in some way, maybe we can be privy to what you find and let us know what that is. And in the meantime, thank you so much for being on with us and have a wonderful day. And hopefully we can talk to you at some point in the future.
Okay. I look forward to that.
All right, doctor. Have a good one. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay. I thought that went well.